Greetings to our global neighbors and all the ships at sea. From coast to coast, border to border, this is Message Traffic from Washington, D.C., presented by the New York Center for Foreign Policy Affairs.
Hello, I am Valentina Doran, a Foreign Policy Fellow at NYCFPA. And this is Message Traffic. Welcome back to the two-part series, U.S.-Russia Relations, The Current Roots of the Crisis, Part 2. This episode, we answer the question, what can be done? Listen to find out what our speakers believe are the solutions.
Some experts, even in the United States, are expressing their doubts whether joining the NATO by former Soviet Union countries like Ukraine and Georgia is in the interest of the United States. And for instance, recently, Senator Hawley wrote an official letter to Secretary Blinken and asked maybe instead of Ukraine support for the U.S. is more reasonable to go and take a look at China. What do you think?
The funny thing about it is Josh Hawley sending a note to Secretary Blinken talking about the subject, saying that this is basically not important, that this is something that is a regional issue that we should take no concern with, is quite frankly ludicrous. The bottom line here is that there have been failures in both diplomacy, strategy, practical implementation of policy on various fronts. The U.S., I will agree with Bill on one point, is that there is a weakness being demonstrated in our foreign policy, not so much in Biden himself or Tony Blinken himself. It is the implementation of our foreign policy strategy that has fallen short under both a Trump administration, which pretty much kowtowed to a Moscow, and the failure of any sort of clear direction in dealing with Moscow from the Biden administration. The reality now is that we have to look at the other factors that are in play when we look at Russia. Again, agreeing with Bill, the Russian people are wonderful people. Anytime I have dealt with, any of the citizens of Russia, it's always been a wonderful experience, and they have a great love for us just as we do them. The issue is that they are under the control of a very dynamic leadership that is currently, if you look at the numbers, losing traction in the younger demographics and losing support in their electorate. If that is the case, Putin has always been the type that will want to maintain power, and this is a wag the dog situation where he can, in fact, exude his power, show a nationalistic approach to national defense, and get everybody, circling around Mother Russia. We have to take in the fact that we have to give them that the U.S. has to use back channels. Much like we did in the Cuban Missile Crisis, we have to use back channels to try and find a diplomatic out where nobody loses face. Putin is not going to lose face on this. We are trying not to lose face, but quite frankly, the State Department under Tony Blinken is not doing a good job at that. That is the big, this is soft power diplomacy when it should be implemented, referring back to Secretary Baker.
Dakota, I would like to ask you the same question. And also, I would like to ask you about, so we have seen the various tactics that U.S. has used to respond to Russia, right? President Biden is sending American troops to Europe. State Department, meanwhile, is trying to mitigate the crisis through diplomacy. Congress is preparing sanctions, including against mentioned Nord Stream 2. So in your opinion, first of all, do you agree that joining NATO by Ukraine and Georgia is not an interest of the United States? And secondly, how to respond to Russia and what tactics could work here?
I'll go second one first, because I think we're seeing a very inept State Department and the White House approach to this. So let's compare the responses. We're on the American side. It's the threat of various sanctions against billionaire oligarchs who really don't give a hoot about, a tariff or a sanction or something on a particular business venture because they've got all the money they need. And the Russian people in their history have endured tremendous privations, and hardship to accomplish great things, from a Russian perspective. It's not enjoyable, but they have a history, they're hardy people, those sorts of things. So on our side, it's soft power, it's diplomacy and the marches and finger wagging and the threats of use. The deployment of U.S. forces is a drop in the bucket, right? I mean, talking, let's say 5,000 total, these are light infantry folks. It's Stryker vehicles, which are thin-skinned armored vehicles, with wheels instead of tanks with treads. On the other side, and they're going into peripheral countries, right? With a stated U.S. objective of not introducing combat forces into Ukraine at all, right? So it's just to maintain the spillover if Russia should do something. On the other hand, Russia has 1,400 heavy main battle tanks, 1,200 combat aircraft, somewhere around 70 battalion tactical groups, right? 120,000 plus growing forces. They've moved in medical and logistical support and blood supplies and all that. I mean, that is hard power, right? And so I think Putin is looking for some kind of a hard power response. Otherwise, he's just going to do whatever it is that he wants to do. Now, I don't think it's in his interest or objective to take over Ukraine. He wants a disordered Eastern Europe where everybody has to look at Moscow to see if there's approval or what Moscow's intentions or interests might be. Russia and Edward would know this better than anybody. Looks at Ukraine as part of its natural greater Russian territory, the breadbasket of Russia, those sorts of things, right? So the idea that all of these Eastern European countries would be brought under a Western European, U.S. defined influence structure up to the very borders of Russia, that's a catastrophic outcome. Putin is famous for saying that the dissolution of the Soviet Union was the greatest geostrategic disaster of the 20th century, right? So I just don't think he's going to take strongly worded, messages out of Foggy Bottom and State Department as meaning anything. The Munich Security Conference is coming up next week, and the U.S. representative is going to be, Vice President Kamala Harris. I mean, what is her background for doing anything, meaningful or effective on the international stage? So this is a totally unserious approach. And I think somebody like Vladimir Putin, growing up in the KGB, dealing with Chechnya, wanting to see more of a czarist Mother Russia and all of its grandeur, from the 18th, 19th century glories, that's what he's looking for, right? And so he's going to take every opportunity handed to him by the West to be as aggressive and to get as much as easy he can. And China will do the same thing in its sphere of influence, and Iran's going to do the same thing in the Middle East. So a very strong, bullying sort of approach to reach it has to be met with some kind of equal or greater strength to say that this will not be tolerated. And I just don't, I just think that soft diplomacy or soft power isn't going to do much in that regard.
Thank you very much. And Edward, I would like to ask you the question about Germany. And we witnessed a few days earlier the joint press conference of Germany's Chancellor Scholz and President Biden. And members of the press were kind of disappointed that the leaders were giving broad answers. So, and German Chancellor didn't even want to pronounce Nord Stream 2. Does it mean there is still Russian leverage that Russia can use in negotiations with the world, with the West. And in this kind of situation, who is speaking from the position of power, do you think?
Well, we know that Scholz is coming to Moscow.
Yes.
He's going to meet Putin on Monday, this coming Monday. So we'll see how it goes. Problem is that Germany needs gas. This is it's very simple. That Germany is dependent, like what 40% on Russian gas. And by the time, of course, there's some of the other options. This is what Biden is trying to find some other sources of gas. But to replace 40% of gas which is needed for your economy. So he's probably under pressure from his domestic, from his business. And so it's, but now Scholz is not really probably the most interesting figure. I would mention Macron, and because he, now probably is most respected. I don't know, maybe the word respect is not very appropriate here, but at least he claims just by the power of France and French economy and military. French has probably the largest military in Europe, except, of course, if you don't talk about Russia. So he may find something. He can do this, what you call shuttle diplomacy. He went to Moscow, he went to Kyiv, he speaks to Biden. There's one idea which I propose has it kind of courage, or whatever, through Washington Times. I said this is one option because everyone's talking about Minsk agreement. Minsk agreement. It's Biden is talking about this. EU is talking about this. Russia is talking about it, and Ukraine simply cannot implement those agreements. And most important, UN also accepted that this is a basic for getting out of this crisis and actually avoiding larger conflict. So we have all those powers, and then we have, I'm sorry to say, comical president. Well, he came from stage, right? Everyone understand that. So he cannot implement them because he's afraid. He's afraid of the same people, the New York Times, is now warning that we can get also problems. Remember when in the Soviet days, we armed, financed Mujahideens and helped them to defeat Soviets. And actually I was applauding at the time, all of us. But then what happened? All those Mujahideens with Stingers and all that thing, they turned in against the United States and we had 9/11. So now, if you listen carefully to what's going on in Ukraine, there's some folks who are saying similar things, that if the West will try to push us to implement this Minsk agreement, we will turn against the West. So we are now going to be repeating the same mistake we did in Afghanistan. So what I suggest to Macron, and actually I have some contacts in France, and my old contacts. Macron can do this. He can introduce a resolution to UN that if we, Zelensky implements Minsk Accords and he's in trouble with radicals, then we can send peacekeepers. So let's see who will vote against. We'll see if, who will vote, veto this resolution, United States or England, because Russia, China, and France will vote 3 votes yes. And we'll see who was, Boris Johnson, the laughable stock of Europe. And okay, anyway, this is my...
Yeah, thank you very much. And I would like to ask Justin. I see he is ready to talk. Justin,
I want to get Bill and Dakota first, but the one quick thing I want to say is the one fact that we're still not talking about is the fact that the deep-rooted memory of Ukrainian people when it comes to Moscow and Russia. The number of Ukrainians that I speak to that still have a deep resentment to Russian power and the threat of Russian influence on Kiev and on the Ukrainian people, they still remember Stalin. And that is a big deal that nobody wants to talk about. This is, in their eyes, you talk to some of my friends in the Ukraine, they'll tell you this is very reminiscent and very Stalin-esque. But I go to Dakota and Bill to get their take on this.
Yeah, Dakota, you're welcome.
Yeah, so just real quick, because I want to hear Bill, but so the Ukrainian people are one thing, but we're talking about what the United States and the other big powers do to dissuade or to deter Russia from taking action in the first place, right? So if it's important enough for Russia to move in and deal with a bunch of angry Ukrainians, I mean, they'll do that, right? They can overwhelm them with fires and those sorts of things. So I think our discussion here is about U.S.-Russia relations and what the major players are doing. You know, to what Edward was saying is that Germany has refused use of its airspace to Great Britain and others to fly munitions and other types of support to Ukraine. So that kind of illustrates where Germany is at, you know, right here at the moment. It was, what was her name? Elizabeth Truss, the UK foreign minister, met with Lavrov, you know, in some of these discussions, and he walked off the stage. He said, look, I'm not going to be lectured, you know, by the Brits on, you know, human rights and environmental conditions and those sorts of things. So clearly the Russians have no respect, you know, for Great Britain. And so whether it's Boris Johnson and his cabinet office or what have you, they don't seem to be any influence as well. So where we see Germany and France dealing directly with Russia, essentially cutting the U.S. out of that, right? I mean, minimizing any influence from Washington at the moment. It could be that Macron and the new leadership in Germany cut some kind of a side deal, right, with Russia. And I think that if Putin can get a strategic win by having vetoes inside of NATO, right, whether it's further expansion or NATO involvement in anything in Ukraine, you have to have unanimity, right, a unanimous vote to do that. So if Germany says no, you get a strategic win. And so I think Russia is pulling all these levers to regain influence on the continent and to keep a destabilized Eastern Europe and a Western world that doesn't press up against the borders of that country.
I want to hear what Bill says, because I want to definitely respond to what Dakota said.
Bravo. We have agreement here, at least a little bit. So, Bill, my question to you, who is speaking from position of power here in this crisis? You know, following up the question.
I think it's Putin. Because everyone's going to Moscow to meet with him, whether it's the president of Hungary, president of France, and now a chancellor of Germany going there. And what he's wanted to get personal respect, I believe. And of course, Trump gave him that, no matter what we would think of that. So that was something that he liked from President Trump. So he wanted personal respect, but also he wanted to put Russia back at the center of things. And he certainly has done that. He has fractured, I don't think fatally, but he has fractured NATO. And Dakota was just talking about the attitude of Germany. And so that's a fracturing. Of course, France isn't in NATO anyway, but they're maneuvering to be influential with Russia, to step out on the stage. So I think that Putin is speaking from a position of power. But what we hear from him, and I think even more so from Lavrov, is, you know, they're interested in convenings. They want to get together at a table where they're speaking. And also they want agreements, even though they may violate agreements over the years. You know, we've had all these agreements and treaties over the last 30 years or more. And so they want some documentation here. I mean, that's what they really wanted, again, going back 32 years ago. But Baker and Bush and Scowcroft denied them anything on paper about NATO expansion. And despite the assurances given that were verbal, they've learned not to trust the United States. So I think that they want, you know, meetings and treaties and agreements. That's what they'll be. And I think if we can offer that quickly, we can avoid an immediate military conflict. But someone's got to have a grand design in mind here. And again, I would turn back to Michael McFaul's article in Foreign Affairs. I've not been a particular fan of his, but I think there's some things worth pondering in that article, Dateline Today.
Well, let me just jump in here, Katya, because okay. there's one factor that we also have to look at. It's like, look, Putin is not crazy. Putin is not an idiot. Putin, the timing of this coincides with the back end and the still changing dynamic of a brand new administration coming in from Biden. Putin knew that there was going to be a dynamic shift in probably the most stabilized leadership in Europe and in NATO when we saw Chancellor Merkel be replaced by Chancellor Scholz. There's going to be a dynamic power vacuum and shift in power there. The only true, solid, stabilizing adult in the room on continent then becomes Macron. Putin knows this. Putin took advantage of that and therefore sits at power almost by a de facto, if you will, almost a de facto proxy of power. He's got the upper hand, but it's not by lack of unity in NATO. I think NATO still stands strong. I think the changes that have happened in the key figure countries of NATO is what is pressing this to be very difficult for NATO right now.
Okay, and Edward, paraphrasing this question as whole in these circumstances, in your opinion, who is the biggest winner in this crisis?
Unfortunately, no one is winner, because we, if we have the crisis and war, then all of us are going to lose. So one idea, another, I keep generating some crazy ideas, but this is my job. I'm teaching at college, so I'm trying to get young people involved as well. So one crazy idea I already mentioned is like a UN peacekeepers protecting Ukrainian president from radicals if he starts implementing a Minsk agreement. Another crazy idea is to have a summit, but this is this game which Senator Hawley and some others say, well, let's get easy on Russia because China is a major threat. All this game is not working. And maybe it could work in 1991 when China was weak. China is now very strong, and Russia is weaker, of course, economy, but military is also very strong. So normal, you know, I'm a physicist, so I'm trying to be logical. What you do, you have not playing games, we are with Russia against China, or we in with China against Russia. It wouldn't work now. Three leaders have to meet. I call it Yalta 2. Of course, Yalta 1 was not perfect because Eastern Europe was under Soviet kind of a domination. And I actually was the one who protested that. And actually, I even stayed with Ukrainians who I didn't like when I wasn't born at the time. But when Stalin took over Western Ukraine, I think it was a criminal act. And so we need a summit. We need a summit of U.S. president. I didn't think that Biden is ready for that, or he's actually can accomplish something. And this has to be a meeting with Putin, Xi Jinping, and American president, whoever it might be, and have this Yalta 2. And we will agree that how we're going to live in the new century when the United States is no longer in just a leader, which many countries don't recognize this, and we. You know, Bill and everyone else now probably agrees that yes, is no longer what they call hegemon world. So we have to, you know, accept that. I know it's painful. If you're sitting on the top of the hill and someone tells you come down a little bit because you're one of many, you're not the only superior, it's painful. But, you know, every empire has to at some point accept that. And British Empire and Soviets and Rome, we know this from history. So this summit of three, ideally it will be five with two other members, but Britain is now in such a terrible shape that it's probably useless. So Yalta 2, this is my answer.
Dakota, speaking of tactics, so as we know, U.S. Congress now in an active discussion about sanctions. And there is a question, choose the sanctions as a preventative measure or after a potential invasion if it happens? How do you see sanctions tool and what is your advice here?
Yeah, there's pros and cons for each side. You know, the pro to preventive or very proactive sanctions up front, it'd send a very, very strongly worded signal. An overused term, but that's the term of art here, right? So this, we take this this crisis so seriously that we're going to impose economic costs up front. You know, the harm or the risk on that is that actually prompts military action. You know, it would be like the Western powers in the U.S. Cutting Japan off from its oil supplies, you know, that really prompted it to get even more muscular and precipitated a lot of Imperial Japan actions, you know, at the very beginning of World War II there in the late 1930s, right? So you could actually generate the very military crisis that presumably these kinds of preemptive sanctions are meant to stop, you know, or to prevent. So there's risk in that. If you wait until after military action, right, then it's a reactive sort of thing. So once you've pulled a trigger, there is no way to know how that war is going to turn out. I mean, talking about historical examples, right, which are very, very instructive. Once a civil war breaks out, a war between countries breaks out, you just don't know where that's going to go, right? So, you know, Russian forces go into Ukraine, Ukraine fights back, Poland is concerned, Lithuania is concerned, I mean, everybody else surrounding them is concerned. And now you're going to impose economic sanctions as if that's going to take, you know, Vladimir Putin and say, oh, I'm sorry, now we can't export energy to a Europe that is critically dependent on energy, right? Or bauxite or whatever, you know, crappy caviar out of the, you know, the Caspian Sea or something like that. So I'm not really sure what reactive sanctions would do, but there is a benefit of why precipitate? You know, why don't we hold that out as a threat, you know, as we move forward, and perhaps it would be significant enough to keep that first trigger from being pulled. So, I mean, there are arguments either way. And I think the only ones who can really make that decision are those who are most directly involved in these discussions going on between capitals. Because to Justin's point, I mean, there is background chatter. You know, there are conduits of information trying to assess who is really doing what. You know, the preparations that the Russians have made, are they really on hair trigger alert? You know, and so it's a very frustrating thing for those of us on the outside to want to say, well, this is a solution, but we're working with partial information, right? And so all I could really do is lay out the pros and cons of each approach and then trust that, you know, folks who have their fingers on the real-time pulse on a day-to-day, you know, make the appropriate decision. But I'm not confident that the Biden team is going to do that. I agree with Edward that the UK is irrelevant. And it's really going to come down to the willingness of France and Germany and some others to really step up to the plate. Clearly, Poland is going to be a major player, but they're more interested usually in protecting Warsaw than in projecting Polish forces in anybody else's country, right? So we're just going to have to take this day by day.
Justin, in your opinion, proactive or afterwards in regards to sanctions?
Well, again, to Dakota's point, it's how they're used. They can be very effective if used correctly. Do, you know, if we, you know, this country, both under going back to Obama and then Trump using them badly, and now we're seeing them being used badly by this administration, it gets to the point where it has the political or power equivalent of, you know, if you keep doing this, we're going to get really, really angry and we're going to send you a very, very stern note. That only goes so far. And quite frankly, the Kremlin understands that. We're also kind of caught in a weird situation where, you know, if we use sanctions now, or, you know, how far do we push it? Do we Do we go another step further and use something outside the box like the Global Magnitsky Act? Or do we have Biden use his executive order powers for sanctions? When do we use it? Do we do it before? And then we have a situation like Dakota pointed out in Japan where they're like, all right, sanction us, fine. We're marching to Kiev. If we do it after, does that just hurt the people we're trying to protect? More aggression on the Ukrainian people that we're trying to protect, and that puts an economic pressure on, quite frankly, the Russian people who most Americans don't have any quarrels with. So, you know, it's a matter of, can they be? Yes. If done right, and if we can erase some of the history of us misusing it in the past.
Thank you very much. And following up question about sanctions, about diplomacy. If the traditional ways don't work, maybe we're supposed to use public diplomacy. And as we remember, this type of diplomacy, people-to-people cooperation, prepped and made the Reagan-Gorbachev meeting in Geneva happen. So will it work this time? Bill, first to you, it's your professional expertise about people-to-people cooperation. Can it work this time?
Well, I think it's not going to work in the short term, the immediate crisis. I think that's something that we have to continue to pursue very actively, people-to-people diplomacy. And I think both the individuals that I've met, the organizations on local levels, as well as on up through the government bureaucracy, and including actually the embassy in Washington, D.C., have always been encouraging to this. So they're quite open to it. But that's a medium to long-term solution. It's not going to solve the current crisis. And I would just go back to the issue of the sanctions. I think that, that's a confrontational approach, ineffective afterwards and confrontational before. And what we need is not confrontation, but mechanisms for engagement. That's what we need. And again, to me, this is some kind of convenings at multiple levels where Russia and Putin can be center stage and feel that they have been not only respected, but their concerns listened to. I think that's what needs to be done. And I think if we can come up with something that's compelling for whether it's a summit or something, some kind of summit amongst a few people, I think that can avert immediate military action. One other comment I'd make, despite all of the concerns that the Russians have, and anything that they would do, to me, this would be an unprovoked act and would be seen as that. You know, there's no provocation here for the Russians to march into Ukraine. The big issue is NATO expansion. Ukraine wants it, or some people want it. So anyway, I think it would be disastrous in the view of the world and world history for Russia to march into Ukraine unprovoked.
Thank you very much. And Edward, question, same question. As we remember, this approach was about delivering American values, cultural cooperation. Even every American knows the word glasnost. Will this approach work now? What is your suggestion? What is the solution here?
Well, Bill, I think I mentioned this, that you mentioned no provocation, but it could be a provocation. If you see what's going on in Kyiv now, especially in this border with Donbas, when the masses of the military and even more dangerous, those what you call private radical battalions, heavily equipped, unfortunately, with sometimes American weapons, because all those tons of weapons which are now landed in Ukraine, they can end up, it's probably already in the hands of those radicals. So if they move on, that's a provocation. But in terms of what to do, yes, I agree. This is what I'm doing, people's diplomacy. And we were doing this for many, many years on Capitol Hill, by the way. On Capitol Hill, He had annual U.S.-Russia forum when we were bringing a lot of, of course, members of Congress, Russian deputies. We had business people, cultural figures, university professors. And we were talking about how we can, promote and go from this confrontation. I keep calling about alliance. Everyone's told me, forget about alliance. Let's talk about partnership, friendship, or maybe a little bit milder form. And we did it on Capitol Hill for like almost 30 years. Now you can't do it because, first of all, the atmosphere is not, everyone in Congress who would say something, not even pro-Russian, like Senator Hawley, he was just talking, let's get Russia and fight against China. This is so even he calls Putin's agent. The only reason, the only one voice is Senator Rand Paul. Senator Rand Paul is probably only out of 100. It's a sane voice. He actually was running for president. He didn't go too far. But another voice on Democratic side, Tulsi Gabbard. Tulsi Gabbard, we know that she was member of House and she was running for president as well. And she's saying exactly the same things as I do. can you imagine? I am Republican. She's Democrat. But so we have what we call, she is now no longer, maybe she lost her job because of what she's saying. But people to people, I think, also we finished the thing, I will send you my new project. I think I mentioned this to Bill already. I composed music for peace. And it's a video when people from the United States, from Russia, from Ukraine, by the way, I included Ukrainians as well, they all talking about let's make peace, not war. So this is something that the best thing we can do because we are not in the government.
Thank you very much, Edward. And Dakota, you as a military expert, do you believe in public diplomacy?
Absolutely. Anybody who spent time in uniform would rather not have things being shot at them, right?
If I may just jump in, and I'm sure that Dakota will mention this or recall it. There was some famous general, I think, under Trump, I forget what position, he had so many generals in different positions, which said that if you don't use diplomacy, then I've got to buy more bullets.
Right. Yeah, and you know, Churchill, you know, better to jaw than to war, right? I mean, so I think military professionals would just hope that economic measures and diplomacy and all those things, you know, work. The last thing you want is to send your sons and daughters into a battlefield, you know, a million casualties on the Somme, right? I mean, it's, you know, the world has seen, Europe has seen wars that are just so destructive, and you don't want that. And yet, when we think about our own personal lives, if you don't have a police force in a town, right, that presents competency, that's out there policing streets and all that, then, you know, gangs and criminal elements tend to take over, right? And so whether it's a country or it's a personality in a country, we do see the rise of strong influences who, if they can't get their way by talking, right, then they'll get their way with military power. You know, look at what Assad has done in Syria, right? Or Iran is trying to do in the Middle East by funding all sorts of, terror groups like Hezbollah and Hamas and whatnot. It's not Chinese declarations that push aside Vietnamese fishing fleets. You know, I mean, it's maritime militia, Chinese Coast Guard, and Chinese Navy and stuff. So there is this aspect of military power that has to be met with military power. And so I think if the West does not stand up militarily to show Russia and Vladimir Putin in particular that there will be extraordinary costs if this unprovoked aggression, you know, goes forward, then it will be war, right? So, but from a military guy, I pray that diplomacy works every day and people-to-people engagements. I mean, what a great world it would be if we could work out all those things. It's just when those things don't work, it's too late to build the military that you need to then, you know, fend off, you know, German Wehrmacht, you know, in 1939, right? Or you know, the Japanese who marched, you know, into China, or, you know, those sorts of things. So there's historical examples where if somebody's going to use military power, you have to have capabilities at capacity and with competence to deal with that situation. So my vote is for diplomacy,
Great.
Great. But you have to be prepared if that doesn't work.
And thank you very much. And Justin, as you know, we're a little bit running out of time, but public diplomacy, what we are doing in our center, right? And I would like you to give some speech in this regards. And are you for public diplomacy or for military solution?
Well, don't say give a speech. Very short comments. Otherwise, Justin will take 30 minutes.
It's to meet you, Mr. Kettle. The great thing about this is, you know, as somebody who also served in the U.S. military, I completely agree with Dakota. We would much rather see diplomacy rather than the active engagement of warfare. I do also want to go back and comment on something that Bill brought up, is the fact that, yeah, you know, when we had a, you know, we all remember the pictures on the television of Reagan greeting Gorbachev at the Governor's Island at the various bilateral meetings that the two leaders had, and it was a show of not only of respect publicly or privately, but publicly it showed a mutual respect to each other, and there also showed a mutual humility of each other, and they put each other on equal ground back then. I don't think that could be doable today. The idea of perestroika and glasnost, I don't think could exist in a social media info juggernaut. Not real. However, we have to find a way. This is exactly the reason why we have to control power. Using the idea that the U.S. is back channels to the Ukraine saying, hey, Kiev, don't push the NATO idea. In fact, just tell everybody publicly you don't want to join NATO. And however we do it, we're not saying that you can't, it's your decision, we're not going to push it, but it might be a good idea to maybe back away from the NATO comments in order to allow Putin to get a virtual win, if you will. We have to use back channels to get to Putin to say, hey, you are literally building up 150,000 troops. That's real aggressive. You might want to back down, because if you do unprovoked march to Kiev, you're going to have a global problem. Not only are you going to look like a bully, but you're going to hurt your economy, because everybody else that's depending on your natural gas is going to look for other sources, such as, you know, LNG coming out of Qatar or all the natural gas resources in the North Sea. There has to be back channel diplomacy. That's how a lot of this is staving off disaster. And we're just, because it's back channel, we may not be seeing it. I just don't get the impression that we're seeing it. But that is the way this gets solved.
So thank you, every one of you, for this great discussion. And I think the conclusion is just perfect, right? The suggestion and solution is to find the way to the public diplomacy, people-to-people cooperation, and instead of using weapon, using bridges. So thank you, everyone.
Yeah, just 1 second. Dakota, listen, let's people-to-people. I want to be invited back to Heritage Foundation, or I can invite you for coffee. We can continue this discussion. I am in Washington, so perhaps we can start this people-to-people.
Great. You see, we found the solution, and I'm happy to see every one of you. Thank you for participation. It was great discussion, and I hope to see you soon, and have a nice weekend, everyone. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Yes. Wonderful.
Edward, absolutely. We'll be in touch. Thank you.
Okay.
For more information on the subject you just heard about, or any of our articles, reports, or events, log on to nycfpa.org. Also, please consider subscribing to Message Traffic on your favorite podcast service like Apple, Google, Spotify, or TuneIn Radio. You can also follow us on social media by searching for us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. For questions regarding the center, or just to let us know what you were thinking, you can email us at info@nycfpa.org. On behalf of the board and staff of the New York Center for Foreign Policy Affairs, thank you for listening.